නමෝ තස්ස භගවතු ආරහතෝ සම්මා සම්බුද්දස්ස නමෝ තස්ස භගවතු ආරහතෝ සම්මා සම්බුද්දස්ස නමෝ තස්ස භගවතු ආරහතෝ සම්මා සම්බුද්දස්ස අපරුතාතේ සම අමතස ద్వාරා යසෝ තමන්තෝ උපමන්චන්තු සදාන්ති. So this evening I'd like to give a Dhamma talk on a topic which is hopefully of interest to the good people assembled here, and that is how to get enlightened. So the brief answer is practice the Eightfold Path. And here's the slightly less brief answer. So if we want to get enlightened, the first thing we have to do is to suffer. And if we don't suffer, then we're not going to be interested in finding a way out of suffering. Of course, everyone's suffering all the time, so it's usually not too hard to meet that criteria. But it depends on the individual how much suffering that they need to have and what kind of suffering. And of course, there are many people who suffer very greatly, but who don't find any spiritual nourishment out of that. So there has to be a kind of wisdom there as well. And so that's one thing that tells us it's important that we can't push it, especially when it comes to other people. And, you know, there's many people who we meet who really just don't get it. You know, they really just don't understand about Buddhism and the path and all of these kinds of things. So until we've suffered to enough depth for our wisdom to be able to get it, then, you know, we just can't understand why this would be the case. So, when we're suffering and we're actually feeling that pain, that inner turmoil, the anxiety, the depression, then we're kind of drawn to that. Our mind nags away at it. We tend to proliferate about it, we cogitate about it, we're going to go on and on about how we're depressed or about, you know, who's done us wrong or all of these things. And so often that process is not very useful, it's just sort of going round and round the same things. But it does signify, at the very least, it signifies that there's some degree of turning of the mind inward and reflecting about the causes in the mind. So there's at least a start there. But for many of us, and certainly it was the case for myself, that we don't really get it, we don't really have an idea of what's going on and what we can do about it until we actually encounter the Buddha's teachings. And of course, when we first encounter the Dhamma, you know, usually it's just at a superficial level, just at an intellectual level, and we sort of, you know, we sort of get a few of the ideas and get a few tips and things like that, but it's not really, doesn't really move us yet very deeply. And there comes a certain point in time when we actually come to be very deeply moved by the Dhamma. Of course, it may happen many times, not just one off, but usually when we start a practice, there's a certain point where we have this feeling, and the word in Pali is sangvega, feeling of agitation or inspiration, the feeling of that there's something that needs to be done, the feeling that there's a contact here with something real, something urgent. So when we have that kind of suffering, with that wisdom and that realization that something needs to be done, then we start learning in earnest. The first thing that we have to do is we have to try our best to understand the teachings, at least a little bit. We don't necessarily have to understand everything, but we have to get the basic ideas straight in our heads. We have to clarify for ourselves some of the very important principles of the Dhamma, the idea of karma, the notion that one's suffering is ultimately caused by oneself. And that while superficial or temporary forms of suffering are indeed attributable to external causes, but the real suffering, the really important stuff, comes from within. So that there's a certain, we have to bring that to consciousness. We have to keep on going over that. We have to keep on reminding ourselves of this. And so we do this through that the process of reading Dhamma books, listening to Dhamma talks, discussing Dhamma with our friends, thinking about it, and so on. And this is all the purification of the first factor of the path, is right view. And it's very important to do this, and we can't skip over it. Very often, when we come to Dhamma practice, in my experience, many people are quite lazy. They want to jump over all of the beginning stages of practice and go right to the end. And they kind of do that for a while, and then they realize it, wonder why it's not working. So you've got to start by building up these foundations. Correcting your view, examining your views is very, very important, and is really essential to getting your path on the way. I can't emphasize that strongly enough. The Buddha emphasized this again and again and again in the suttas, from right view, that all of the other factors of the path follow. If your view is wrong, then all of the other factors are wrong. And the problem is that views are not self-correcting. You can't expect that when you're practicing the Dhamma, that if you have wrong views, that somehow that will be corrected by your practice of Dhamma. In some cases, it might be. In some cases, that can happen. But in many other cases, it's not. So you can do all the meditation that you like, but if you've got wrong view when you're going into the meditation itself is simply going to reinforce that wrong view. It's not going to change it. So just to give an example of this, you know, imagine somebody who was doing meditation because they wanted to achieve union with a deity, and they'd sit there and meditate, and then finally they'd get a nimitta or a jhana or some other kind of profound experience, and then they immediately would say, oh yes, that's that union with the deity that I was looking for. This is it. This is heaven. This is nirvana. This is the absolute. This is whatever I've been searching for. And from then on, it's not possible for somebody else to dissuade them. Once you've had that experience yourself, it's very, very hard for anybody to detach you from it. Because, well, it's my experience. You can't tell me that my God doesn't exist because I've seen my God. And of course, the underneath it all is that you're interpreting your experience because of your views, which you've already had before you started the meditation. And we all do this. We are all going to interpret our experience at a very fundamental level in accordance with our views. And that's why right view is a precursor for the whole Eightfold Path. And that's why we can't skip over that. Yeah, it's fine if we want to just go and do a meditation retreat or something like that, but if we want to get really serious and start developing the Eightfold Path over a lifetime, perhaps many lifetimes of steady development, then we're going to need to make sure that our view is right. We're going to have that inquiring mind, wanting to know, wanting to ask, wanting to find out, wanting to examine. And always having the humility to change your views when it's needed. Yeah, this is that attitude of a student or a learner, is that they're always wanting for their views to be corrected, and not trying to study in order to validate your views, but in order to improve them. So, once we have that practice of we have that notion of correcting one's views. The idea of correcting your views is essentially an internal process. It's an individual process. Yes, it has an external dimension in the sense that you learn from a teacher or you discuss with friends or whatever. But the views themselves are internal. But then there's a whole other realm of Dhamma which is also an external realm of Dhamma. And then those things are also things which need to be looked at very carefully. So of course it's the sila, the right speech and so on. Right livelihood. So these are things we need to examine in our life and make sure that they're as good as possible. Now, when this, of course, is very different in different contexts. People live in different ways, and the way sila is applied
although the principles are the same, but the details of the application are quite different. Here in a forest monastery, we have the luxury of having the very detailed guide to the sila that's provided in the Vinaya, which gives us very clear boundaries in our ethical conduct. It gives us very clear duties to do in terms of the monastery and the community and so on. And so we should, if we're serious about what we're doing, we should make the effort to learn these things, study them very, very carefully, and study them with a view for how are these things leading to purification of the mind, how are these things leading to enlightenment, how are these things leading to nibbana. And so we should always try to apply these things. And of course this is where we're learning about our own mind on this kind of level. When somebody admonishes us and tells us we've done something wrong, what do we do? Do we get angry and lash back? Do we get kind of defensive and so on? Or do we accept what they're saying and say, well, I'll have a look at that. I need to examine that and see whether that's the case. Yeah, if someone's telling us off or saying something to us, we should thank them for it, because it's taken some courage to do that. And it's something that we can use to improve ourselves. And so whenever we're admonished or whenever anybody asks us to do something, then we should be very gracious about that. We should accept it, you know, go to do it with a good will and a good heart. And when I hear, so from time to time, I hear people say to me that they've asked somebody to do something or whatever, and then they didn't do it, they were stubborn. And I always think, why do people be like that? Why are they trying to do that? So if someone asks you to do something, you just do it. You don't need to argue with them or to be stubborn about it or anything. Just go and do it, and it's okay. And so this is how we notice and develop those qualities within ourselves of humility and the good intention, the kindness and compassion. And again, if we don't build a very rich and deep and broad basis in that wholesome intention and that wholesome motivation all through our activities, then any attempt at developing meditation at a higher level is going to be a failure or possibly even dangerous. It may succeed to some degree, but ultimately it will be undermined by a lack of a broader emotional and ethical development. So don't discount these things. Don't think that they're something small. They're absolutely essential. Yeah? If you can't get over ordinary stubbornness or laziness or pigheadedness or something like that, then there's no way you're going to be able to develop in a higher way in meditation. And when people do this, I talk to people who tell me they have this state of meditation or that state of meditation and so on, and I look at actually how they are as people. And if I see somebody who thinks that they're in these very advanced stages of meditation but is not a nice person, not a wise person or a mindful person or a kind person, then I'm very skeptical about what those states of meditation actually are. I tend not to believe them. I think that this is a kind of power of delusion, and it's not only a delusion in the sense of a simple mistake. It's a more powerful force because it's an active construction of a spiritual identity where I'm the great meditator, and then therefore I don't have to look at all of those other things because they're all beneath me. And this is quite a common kind of attitude you find in Buddhist circles. So this is where we have to look at all of those everyday, ordinary, humdrum aspects of our lives. Yeah? How careful are we in the things we do? How considerate are we? How kind are we? How much have we gone out of our way to help others? How much have we devoted ourselves to the needs of others rather than our own needs? These kinds of wholesome intentions are very fundamental to any kind of higher development. Now, as well as all these things which are common to any kind of practice, then there's the specific monastic duties in the monastery, and looking after your kuti and so on and so forth, looking after the requisites, the bowl and robes, duties towards the other Sangha members, the duties towards the seniors in the Sangha, and so on. And so these are all things which, again, are a very essential part of training the mind. Now, early in the year, we looked in some detail at the gradual training. And many of the practices which are mentioned in the gradual training are there because they are specially relevant in the monastery and for those of us who are coming along and who have decided to train ourselves in this way for the rest of our lives. And these are things like contentment in eating, mindfulness and clear comprehension, sense restraint, restraint with the requisites and so on, not sleeping too much, and all of these kinds of things. And these are all quite, in a way, quite basic trainings. Not saying they're basic in the sense of being easy, but they're basic in the sense of being fundamental to the holy life, and things which are doable. They're things which are actually, you know, almost everybody can actually accomplish these things. And so we need to keep on training ourselves with these to try to see how good we can make that. And of course that's different for every person. So for example, something like how much do we sleep? And that really depends on the individual. Some people need more sleep and some people need less. For some people the problem is sleeping too much, for other people the problem is sleeping too little. So that we need to try to find that middle way. Most of us tend to incline towards sleeping too much, and that's especially in the monastery where we are we don't have so many duties and demands on us and these kinds of things. So we sleep is one of the easiest ways to pass the time. So don't let that get to you, don't let that be the case. Make sure that you only sleep as much as you need and push yourself. Try just pushing yourself to see how little sleep you can get away with. Stay up later at night, get up earlier in the morning, and push yourself through tiredness. And do that again and again and again. So that you learn how much do you really need. And maybe you'll surprise yourself. Maybe you'll find that you only need 4 hours sleep a night, or you only need 5 hours sleep a night. And many people are like that. Yeah, many people need even less sleep than that. There's no one kind of right period of time. So again, similarly with eating and with food, and some people have 2 meals a day, some people 1 meal a day, and so on. So just experiment, see how much you need, what kinds of foods are going to be useful for you, and so on. But generally speaking, at the meal time when we're taking our food, the normal most basic practice is to just take a bit of everything. At the mealtime, just take a spoonful of every dish that's there, and that's good enough to survive for another day. And that's all we really need to eat for. So we're not eating because we're looking forward to the flavours or the special foods or all of these kinds of things. Just eating towards the goal of just thinking, may I just survive one more day? Can I get through today until tomorrow? Is this enough food? Is this sufficient for me to survive till tomorrow so that I can keep on practicing? And this is how we should relate to our alms food. Don't get caught up in it. Don't get distracted by it. Don't obsess about it and think about it. Don't worry about it. The food is there. If it's not there, it's not there. And if it is there, we just take enough to live on and we can get on with our practice. That's all. And take the same attitude with the other requisites that we have, the robes, the kuti, all the different things we might have. These days we have bits of technology. Some of us have laptops or MP3 players and these kinds of things. And so again, we use these things because they're useful. They have a genuine function, but don't get attached to them. Don't make a big deal about it. You know, if you ask yourself, what does that mean? If I'm going to be attached to it, yeah. How do I know whether I'm really attached to something or not? The answer is very simple: whether you can get rid of it without worrying. Okay, so if you think, well, if I'm going to, accumulated a shelf full of books in my kuti, which I own, which are my personal books, what's going to happen when I leave here? If I go stay in another monastery, what's going to happen to those books? And if that starts to become a weight on your mind and you're thinking, well, I should package them up and I should put them in a box and maybe someone can keep them or something, then you're attached to them. Yeah? If you're not attached to them, you just say, I'll just give them away. I'll leave them in the monastery library or give them away somewhere. And that's where you know that you're not attached. If there's not a second thought with those things. And when I was in Thailand and I decided to come back to Australia, I had a few books which I had accumulated there. I had the Digha Nikaya and Majjhima Nikaya and a few other things. And when I came back to Australia, I just gave them away. I gave them to the Sangha without a second thought. Just, okay, here you go. And then I just went on. So when I arrived here at Santi, I had all of my possessions with me, my bowl and my monk's bag. That was it. That was the entire possession. I didn't have anything else anywhere in the world that I owned. And that was it. So that's all you need. And, the day will come the day might come that I leave here. And on the day that I leave here, that's all I'll take with me. Maybe my laptop. Maybe not. Wait and see. I'll probably take the files anyway, even if I don't take the laptop. Because that's all you need in life. Everything else is a burden. I wasn't meaning laptop, I was meaning the requisites and stuff. So this is where we have to keep on testing ourselves with these things. Keep on letting go. Keep on doing it again and again and again. This is your practice. It's the essence of the practice. Until you're very confident about it. When you've let go again and again and again, without worrying about things, without giving them a second thought. And then you know, okay, that you have that capacity, and then you're able to use things without worrying about it too much. And then, but you keep an eye on it, because the attachment creeps back. You have to be careful. You keep on watching. The attachment creeps back, and then if you find that's getting too much, then you need to let go some more. So always the story I remember was the story really made a big impression on me. It was the story of Jnanavira, the German monk, English monk living in Sri Lanka. And when he had a visitor there who came, and he was just living in a kuti, a bundala kuti, in the middle of the forest. And they asked him some questions, and they were having some Dhamma discussion, and then the layman left. And before he left, he said, "Oh, Bhante, is there anything I can offer you? Do you need of any requisites?" And Jnanavira said, "No, there's nothing I need." And then when he was leaving, he had to write down this fellow's phone number. And so he wrote it down, and he got out a pencil, and the only pencil he had was just like a little stub of a pencil, a couple of inches long. And that was the only pencil he had in the kuti. And still, when he was asked, "What do? Is there anything you need?" He said, "No, I don't need anything, because that's enough. One little stub of a pencil, 2 inches long, is enough." So that's the attitude that we should always take when people ask us, "Do you need anything? Do I really need anything? No, don't need anything." So this is how we're practicing with the contentment and the restraint and all of these kinds of things. So when those things all coming together, and when we put attention to them, give value to them, make them something important, and then when we have a good foundation on those things, and we're ready to do some meditation. And when it comes to meditating, the central thing, or the most important thing, is the subjective side of meditation, like what kind of attitude do you bring to it? It's not so much the object of meditation, which, you know, you can try different meditation objects and different meditation systems, and they can all have some value. But at the end of the day, what really matters is this, the subjective attitude that you're bringing to the meditation object. And that subjective attitude that you're bringing to the meditation will, of course, be conditioned by how you're using your mind outside of the meditation. Obviously, you all know this. You're all meditating, and you all know that how you think and act and so on during the day will affect how your meditation happens when you go back to your kuti. So we bring that attitude to meditation, that attitude that of just rightness and right balance. Just enough. Just enough. Just paying attention, not too pushing too hard and not being too lazy, not being too too much in a hurry, but then not being too holding back. Just right. We're just holding the meditation object just firmly enough to keep it in mind, but not so firm that we're crushing it and pushing it hard and getting a samadhi headache for our troubles. So bringing that attitude of constant care to the meditation. Now, when we're practicing meditation, of course, you have the two aspects, the samatha and vipassana. And those two aspects always should go together. They should always support each other. It's one of the great heresies, as you know, as I've written about and spoken about many times, is one of the great heresies of modern Buddhism is that they put samatha and vipassana as opposition, and that they're somehow different kinds of things which somehow oppose each other or compete with each other. And this is very far from the truth, and it's a very unhealthy situation. When meditation is going well, samatha and vipassana are always helping and supporting each other. Samatha being the calmness of the mind, vipassana being the clear seeing and discernment of the mind. And of course, at any time when we're meditating, both of these qualities need to be there. We need to have calmness and we need to have discernment. We need to do those things all the time. But in a matter of emphasis, at any one time we might be emphasizing one or other of these qualities, or not. Sometimes they can come together in perfect balance. So most people, most of the time, will emphasize the aspect of samatha earlier on in the practice. So what we're trying to do is to find calm of mind, find peace of mind, and to find integration. And this is one of the meanings of the word samadhi, is like integration of the mind, bringing everything together so that everything works together, like the idea of one-pointedness. And so this is a kind of emotional wholeness which we're developing in the meditation. And this is what samatha practice is all about. So it's not about, you know, completing the details of a meditation technique or mastering this method or this or that. Or it's not about making yourself sit for X number of hours or whatever. None of that stuff is really what samatha is about. Samatha is about that emotional wholeness and that tranquility where everything is just there and is just in its perfect place in the mind and the heart. Everything is just there. When that's developed and deepened, then the mind, of course, will go into absorption, what we call jhana. And jhana, of course, being an essential aspect of the Eightfold Path and being characterized by a withdrawal of the mind into itself. The senses drop away, seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, touching all disappear, and the mind will absorb into a radiant sense of oneness and stillness. And of course that has various levels. I won't go into detail in the levels of jhana. But just the general experience. And so this is the immediate goal, the immediate outcome, not the ultimate outcome, but the immediate goal of doing samatha practice is to reach these states. But of course, what these things are telling us when we practice and we realize these states of concentration, of course, these states are conditioned. We achieve them, we reach these states because we followed a certain path of practice because we've kept our sila, because we've had a wholesome intention, because we've developed our meditation in the right way. And so with the coming together of all of these things, we experience this state of stillness and oneness. And so it's when the mind is primed and ready through its previous development of right view, then it's very natural that the mind will then inquire as to what's going on. Okay, and again, this is, remember the example I gave before of somebody who's maybe a theist or something like that, who will get into samadhi and then they'll say, you know, this is my God, I've come face to face with God, I've reached union with God. And so this is a natural interpretation. If that happens, then you won't proceed further with your practice. Or, for example, if you think that that's nibbana, you think that's enlightenment, you think, oh, I've had a state of samadhi, that's what stream entry is, or that's arahatship. And this is very common that this happens, because the experience of samadhi can be very powerful and it can completely suppress the hindrances for a long period of time. This is one of the signs of a real jhana. And when I was in Perth many years ago, I was talking about this with one of the laymen there who had spent time as a monk in Burma. And he was saying, he'd just been on a retreat with this meditation teacher, and many people on the retreat were saying that they had this kind of jhana or that kind of jhana. And he said he couldn't understand how you could have these jhanas and then be getting up and chatting about what you're going to be cooking or what you're going to be shopping tomorrow, and then getting in your car and driving home and so on. And he said that he had had an experience when he was a monk in Burma. And he'd never only had it once, he hadn't been able to repeat it, but his mind had gone into such a deep state of samadhi. He said for days afterwards he felt he was just like walking around on clouds, like his feet were about 2 feet above the ground. And it was just such a special and such a powerful state of mind that the hindrances are just completely blown away for a long period of time afterwards. So this is the characteristic of a truly profound state of samadhi. And so this is why when people have these experiences, it's very common that they will think that this is some kind of enlightenment experience. Whereas in fact it's not an enlightenment, it's just a state of consciousness. And this is one of the basic things we have to learn through the right view, is that nibbana is not a state of mind, it's not a state of consciousness. Nibbana is the ending of all defilements. And it's nothing to do with having a particular level of samadhi or something like that. So when you have this experience, then the natural tendency will be to investigate this in terms of causality. What brought this about? Why was this experience so blissful? Why was it peaceful? And when you investigate like this, then you begin to realize that it was peaceful because certain things weren't there. The five hindrances weren't there. The five senses weren't there. The mind's not moving around. It's not thinking. It's not worrying. All of these things are absent. The past and the future are absent. They're just not there. And they're absent all these things are absent in a deep sense, in the sense that they're completely non-existent. It's not that they're sort of outside the door waiting to come in, but in that state of consciousness, they're just completely vanished. So through this is why the Buddha said that Nibbana was on the doorstep of, said that jhana was on the doorstep of Nibbana. It was like so close to Nibbana that it was almost the same, almost virtually adjacent to it. So for somebody who has good wisdom and who has studied and understood the Dhamma, then it's very natural that the mind will lead towards deep states of insight following that kind of experience. And when you have those deep states of insight, then they of course will support the further deepening and perfection of the samadhi, because through the insight we're learning to let go, and that letting go is what enables us to reach those states of samadhi. And so when the meditation is proceeding, then we keep on doing this. We keep on following it as deeply as we can. practicing samatha, making the mind still and peaceful as much as we can, and then when the mind comes out of that peaceful state of mind, then using it for investigating, looking at the body, looking at the elements, looking at dependent origination, looking at the five khandhas and so on, investigating them all in terms of one's own lived experience, again and again and again and again. And each time that we're doing that, each time we're seeing impermanent suffering and not self, we're deepening our wisdom a little bit, our insight is getting a little bit closer, we're learning a little bit more, until one day it just happens. One day we just wake up, and the first experience of enlightenment, what they call stream entry, the Buddha described it as like a flash of lightning in a dark night. It's something that happens, it's an event that happens at a defined point in time and place. You know when it is and where it is. Talks about this in the Vinaya, that if somebody claims to be enlightened, then you should ask them, when did it happen? Where did it happen? What was it like? And they should be able to give you very clear and straightforward answer to that. And if they're unsure or confused or uncertain, then that means that it's not real enlightenment. So it's something that happens. It doesn't happen because we make it happen. It happens because all of the causes and conditions are ready for it. So there's no point in pushing or longing for it, or worrying about when it's going to happen or not happen, or worrying if who's going to get it and who's not going to get it, or all of these kinds of things are just a waste of time. You know, we can think, oh, I don't have the baramis to get enlightened in this lifetime, or I'm too old to meditate, or I'm too young and got too many defilements to meditate, and blah blah blah. And all of that is just complete rubbish, and we should throw it out the door and just get on with our practice. So all we can do, the best we can do, is just do our best. We can't determine what the outcome will be. We can't determine when that outcome will happen. But we can say that it's the best thing that we can do with our lives. It's the best thing that we can do with our time right at this moment. And the more that we practice, the closer that we'll get. So we keep on practicing, keep on investigating, keep on inquiring. And then one day, it just happens. It doesn't have to be in meditation. In fact, often it's not in meditation. It can be when you're just doing walking meditation, or doing your chores, or listening to a Dhamma talk, or any time during the day, as long as you're mindful, then that can happen. So this is why we should always be on the lookout, the most unexpected moments, like Venerable Ananda, who became an arahant on the evening before the first council, when he'd been meditating till late at night, and then he was tired and he lay down to rest. And because he lay down mindfully, then he became an arahant, just as his head was about to reach the pillow. Yeah. So it can happen any time. And of course, you know many stories in the Therigatara with the nuns and the monks who, wash their feet, and then the water is draining away, and then they become enlightened, or they put out the lamp in their kuti, and as the lamp is extinguished, their mind becomes freed. These things happening all the time in the text, in the Therigatara and the Therigatara. And this is a very realistic and very authentic aspect of these texts. It sounds to me very, very personal, very, like an account of something that would actually happen. It's quite unexpected, just every day. So, if we practice with deepening our meditation as much as we can, and keeping our mindfulness outside of the meditation as much as we can, keeping that flow of mindfulness, the more and more we practice that way, the deeper the samadhi gets, and the easier it is to maintain the mindfulness. The better our mindfulness is maintained, then the easier it is to get into samadhi. And when that moment comes, then we'll understand. We understand what's been going on. We understand what is that path that we've come on. We understand what's the Four Noble Truths, dependent origination, all of these things which We've been investigating and learning and studying and experiencing. Now we really know at a deep fundamental level. It becomes part of who we are. It becomes an inalienable part of who we are. And so this is that experience of enlightenment. So we can't make it happen. All we can do is nourish the causes. And the more care and the more attention and the more consistency we bring to all of those causes, all of the things I've been talking about this evening, then the easier it will be to realize that fruit of practice. So this is my little talk for you this evening on how to get enlightened. Does anyone have any comments or questions?
I'd say what differentiates the theist looking through the lens with a particular belief, having a particular experience of meditation, and then feeling it's a union with God, to say the Buddhist who with a particular background and understanding of the notion of no self and things has an experience, and you know they say it's no self, and perhaps you know those who believe that you know there's that ultimate union with the self, you know, to find the true self, and someone finds it. Is it all not just still looking through a lens of from a particular viewpoint?
It's a good question, but think about it. Say compare, just as an example, compare it with the dispute between the evolutionists and the creationists. That's what people say, isn't it? Well, you know, evolution is just a theory and so on, and creationism is just a theory. Well, in a sense that's true, but it's true in a very trivial and uninteresting sense. Yeah, of course, they're very different kinds of theories. And evolution is an empirical theory, which is actually grounded on the evidence and can be falsified by the evidence, whereas creationism is not an empirical theory. It's actually a metaphysical theory, which is sort of, you know, grabs some supporting evidence, which is only persuasive for people who already believe that. Yeah? So these are the two different kinds of things. And the essential difference here, if you think about it in terms of epistemology, empirical kinds of truths are truths which in principle can be tested, can be verified. Yeah? Whereas the metaphysical claims, like the existence of God and so on, can't be tested and can't really be known, even in principle. Okay, so if we think about that in terms of meditation, let's say the empirical principles are looking at meditation, impermanence. Right? So we test the truth of impermanence. We can see that. Yeah? We keep on investigating, we actually see impermanence, and we keep on investigating and investigating. Now, we have that as an idea. The Buddha taught impermanence, so things must be impermanent, right? But, well, what if we encountered one day something which really never ever changed? Yeah? So it could be refuted, yeah? But the reality is that everything that we see and investigate and experience actually does change. And the real truth of impermanence is not merely the fact that things in experience happen to change, but that experience itself is dependent on the fact that they change. It's a more fundamental level. But if you compare that with, say, the experience of God, right? You know, I might experience a bright light and a feeling of bliss and so on and so forth in my meditation, but how does that relate to, therefore, there's a being which created the universe? Right? I can't infer from that experience to the idea that someone created the universe. How does it infer from that to the idea that that experience has anything to do with whatever being was written about in the Bible or the Quran or whatever my sacred text might be? There's no connection between those things at all. There's no how can I infer from that experience, which only lasts a certain period of time, how can I infer from that experience and say therefore this thing which I've experienced is eternal? Yeah? This God is eternal. Well, I can't infer from a limited period of time. It feels eternal. The experience feels eternal because psychologically the experience of past and future has been suspended. Yeah? So an impression of eternity. But you don't actually experience eternity, and you never can. You can't possibly ever experience eternity. Yeah? And so there's no experience which can actually verify these kinds of claims. or falsify them. So this is the essential difference.
So anything outside of the experience itself
mm-hmm.
has to on some level be a construct, like a misguided sort of conclusion.
I'm not quite sure what you mean.
So the experience has been had, say, for the
fear. Yeah.
And then everything else that comes after that is like a narrative, a construct that came from reflection upon that experience.
Right, yeah. Which isn't necessarily all wrong,
yeah.
But some of the assumptions that brought into it. Mm-hmm. So, for example, if you have that experience, you have an experience of jhana and you think this is God, well, it's actually pretty close to what the Buddhists say. Because what we say is, well, that's the same experience, which is why the Brahma gods are there. Yeah, it's not a completely wrong theory. It's actually very close to being a right theory. And they say, well, these gods are eternal. Well, Buddhism says, well, they last for many eons, right? It's reasonably eternal. Yeah. Yeah. All things considered. Yeah. So it's not that these things are, completely baseless, but that they just take that step too far. Yeah.
So the experience itself should be almost deconstructed and taken for what it is, rather than adding to the experience.
Very much so. This is why you see in the suttas, there's lots of people meditating in ancient India. So the big innovation, one of the big innovations the Buddha brought in was the ability to describe meditation purely in terms of the actual psychological experience of the person who's having the meditation. He said, well, these factors in the mind are not there anymore and these other factors are present. And he described the meditation experience purely in terms of those kinds of things rather than in terms of union with Brahma or something like that. And so he didn't drag these metaphysical concepts into it. Yeah.
Looking at the jhanas and the jhana, neither perception nor non-perception. So it goes through boundless, and nothingness. So what is actually present in the, what do commentaries say about what's present in the jhana, if neither perception nor non-perception?
Ah, not much. Mindfulness, equanimity. Yeah, and the five khandhas are present. Well, the rupa khandha is not really present. It's kind of only, it's kind of implied or not implied. It's kind of suspended at that time. But the other five khandhas are there because it has the equanimous feeling, so it's vedana khandha, and so on. But this is the perception is, yeah, this is neither quite there nor not quite not there. Which, and that basically, in India, well, it sounds like it's a paradox. It's not meant to be a paradox, actually. In the way that the Indian thought, what that means is simply that it's a kind of a liminal state where it's not present in the normal kind of sense. You know, so you might say that like twilight is neither day nor night. It's not a paradoxical thing. It's just a state of transition, really. So that neither perception nor non-perception is said to be that the perception is still present, but it's so subtle that it doesn't act like perception normally does. Yeah, it's very, very subliminal. Yeah.
So is it effectively
like
there's no real perception as sounds and these five sensory perception or the mental activity, the thoughts are absent, but there is perception at more refined.
No, that's not what it means, because all of those perceptions have already disappeared long before that. Okay, so they've already gone. What this kind of perception is talking about is the perception of the meditation itself. And according to the way the commentaries describe it, which is quite nice, is that in, when you're doing the four rupa jhanas, that your mind becomes expanded until the experience of the light or whatever that jhana is based on becomes infinite. Okay. Then the next stage, that drops away, and where that nimitta was and that light was, there's nothing. Yeah? So that's the base of infinite space. Yeah? There's just the emptiness. You just perceive where that nimitta was. But then the next thing is that the mind turns away from that, even just the perception of space, and just perceives consciousness as infinite. Yeah, so you've gone from infinite space to infinite consciousness. The consciousness which is aware of the infinite space is also infinite. And then the next level of perception is to turn away from even the perception of the consciousness itself, and the perception of nothing, yeah, is even more subtle than infinite consciousness. Yeah, but the perception of nothing is still a perception. Yeah, so then the next one is, well, it's neither perception nor non-perception. So it's really the neither perception. Again, according to the commentarial explanation of that, which I think is quite reasonable, quite good one in this case, it's actually the neither perception nor non-perception is the residual perception that's there after nothingness is let go of.
Perception is nothing to perceive.
Uh-huh.
It sounds like a paradoxical word.
Yeah.
For the Krishna method.
Yeah.
And how is the cessation of perception and feelings different from the state of deep sleep? When we go into deep sleep, there is no other perception or feeling.
Oh, yes, there is. You can still hear things. Someone makes a noise, you wake up. You sleep well, do you? Yeah, no, you still have consciousness in your sleep, yeah, definitely. Yeah.
You seem to be in a sleep, you go through phases, and there is just consciousness, and then there is the consciousness phase where there is the. Then when we come out, then the few hours pass. So it's kind of, there is nothing, absolutely nothing.
But there is, isn't there? Because the mind's still working, you're still having dreams. You can still, subconsciously it's going on. So in that case, what's the thing is that the mind sort of dropped below that threshold of really clear awareness. Yeah? But the dreams and so on are still there. Another thing you can compare that to is just like the comparison of a dark place with a light place. Yeah, because our eyes are so used to the light that it's very hard to see the darkness. And the reason that analogy works is because you think about if you are sleeping, let's say if you're sleeping and you have a dream, yeah? And what happens if you wake out of that dream and you immediately have to do things, right? You have to get out of bed, you have to get dressed, you have to go to work or whatever. And of course you're going to forget that dream very quickly because these other things are making a much more powerful impression on your consciousness. But if you don't have to do those things, if you can wake up slowly and then you reflect back to your dream and you're quiet and still, and then you can still recollect it because your consciousness is still not so bombarded with these other things, like the bright lights aren't still out there. So this is why that's like a kind of a dark place, whereas the jhanas are in a way like the opposite. But because they're also so subtle that they have some things in common, but in terms of actually experiencing them, it's quite different.
Well, Tony, how do we deal with having many duties?
Sorry?
How do we deal with having many duties?
Oh, you just enjoy it. No, seriously, if you enjoy what you're doing, then it's not a problem. Yeah. And then you enjoy it, and then you find meaning in it and purpose in it, and then you're ready to put it down when you finished it.
And your mind still works on it in the background, which emotions.
Oh, yeah, we don't talk about it too much. Yeah, it does, but that's not really a problem. It's because if what you're doing is wholesome and what you're doing is good, then that process of the mind doing those things afterwards is just the integrating of a wholesome and good thing. Yeah, that's all that's happening. If what you're doing is unwholesome, then that's a problem. But if what you're doing is actually wholesome, then it's not a bad thing. So, yeah. And that's the test. If you finish what you're doing, right? Let's say you go and you do your work, right? You finish it, you go away, and then you just don't think about it, stop it, and you just go to meditation. Well, what that's telling you is that you've actually, you know, you practice so that you can integrate those things at that time, and it's not a problem for you. It's not actually throwing up things that need further work. But if you find you can't do that, then that's telling you, well, actually there are still issues there are things that I need to deal with, and so on. And so that's telling you that those things need to be done. Yeah? So you can't skip these things over. You can't leapfrog your way out of these things.
But I see more practically, you know, things like driving, it also causes a lot of mental stress, and there's no real way to get around that, sort of quite a good enough sleep in that sort of. And that, and there's a lot of pressure there, they'll have to kill you and drive due to the sleep or something, so.
Sure.
Just there's not too much you'd expect in terms of mental tranquility and calm to do that.
Sure, but that's not, that. Then you don't. Why are you expecting that?
No.
Yeah. So you have to look for the right, when you're developing things. You have to look for what's the right thing in that case. Yeah. And so in that case, you develop your wholesome intention, your good motivation, the ability to serve others, and so on. That's what you're developing there. And that's to think of that's equally as important as developing the peaceful state of mind in meditation. They're both part of the Eightfold Path, yeah? Practice of Sila and practice of Samadhi are both part of the Eightfold Path.
Yeah.
Yeah?
So I like to focus on this whole game, the people don't have frustration.
Yeah, yeah. It's really important because as long as, I'm not sure if I make myself clear, but as long as when you're doing Sila, as long as you're thinking, I really should be doing Samadhi, yeah? Then you're not really doing your sila properly. You're not valuing what that work of the sila is doing. And it's the same thing if you're doing samadhi. If you're doing samatha meditation, very common fault is that we do samatha meditation, the mind gets a bit peaceful, and then we think, right, I'm going to go and investigate. Yeah? Now we haven't really developed our samadhi deeply enough. Yeah? So again, when we're doing samadhi, we do that as best as we can. When we do the sila, we do that as best as we can, 100%. When we do the wisdom, we do that as best as we can. So of course we all want to get good states of samadhi because that's the most fun thing, yeah? And it's that's the most enjoyable, yeah? But unfortunately we can't live our whole life in the state of samadhi. That's just how it is.
No, it doesn't seem so.
Yeah.
So Manta, we kind of owe it to ourselves, to duty, to do it as well.
Yeah.
When we do sit down to meditate,
yeah.
We don't have to sit there thinking about how we could have done better or the things that we put our
absolutely,
ordinary
yeah.
effort into so we could go and see.
Absolutely.
So we're wasting our time, aren't we?
Absolutely, yeah.
Yeah.
And you know, because when we're working, we're thinking about meditation. Oh, I really should be off meditating. And then when we're meditating, we're thinking about the working. Yeah.
Everything's an opportunity to cultivate and practice.
Absolutely, yeah. But it is important. What I think is important, what's useful, is to put boundaries around these things. Yeah. And to see, this is the time to finish. And you say, well, you know for yourself when is enough enough. And to be able to say enough is enough. To be able to clearly leave these things behind, and so on. This is important. If need be, yeah. I mean, you kind of err on the side of saying yes, and you can err on the side of saying yes 10 times or 20 times or 100 times, and after you've erred on the side of saying yes 100 times, then you might say no occasionally.